Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, May 4th. With us now, New York Times reporter focusing on science and global health, Apoorva Mandavilli. Her widely read article that was published yesterday is called Reaching Herd Immunity is Unlikely in the U.S., Experts Now Believe. We'll also touch with her on the announcement yesterday that the Pfizer vaccine is likely to be approved next week under the current emergency use authorization rules that's in effect for adults for 12 to 15-year-olds. So 12 to 15-year-old vaccination eligibility apparently on the near horizon. Apoorva, we always appreciate when you come on with us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be back, Brian.
Remind people how you define herd immunity for the sake of this article and what real herd immunity would do, and then we'll get into the numbers and what they mean for our risk. So what's herd immunity and what would real herd immunity accomplish?
So the term herd immunity actually just refers to the level of immunity in the population to a virus or a bacterium or whatever the pathogen is. And what we are really talking about when we say herd immunity is this number called the herd immunity threshold, which is some percent of the population that we have to get to where the virus starts to run out of hosts to infect. And so its progress just becomes very slow and we see very few cases. So that's the herd immunity threshold that we've been trying to get to.
And you report that officials used to think 60 or 70% vaccinated or recovered from the virus with antibodies would provide herd immunity. Now they think 80%. Why is that?
So a couple of different things happened. One is that in December, we started to hear about this more contagious variant, B117, that was circulating in the UK. And that's now in the United States as well. It's more than half of the coronavirus cases in most states. And that variant is more contagious than the original form of the virus. And herd immunity threshold is calculated from contagiousness. So a more contagious variant means you need a bigger percent of the population to have immunity. The second thing that's happened, which I know you've been talking about on the show, is the hesitancy that we're seeing in the U.S. population. Something like 30% of the population does not want to get vaccinated, at least at this moment. Hopefully that number will grow smaller as time goes on, but I think it's highly unlikely that we will be able to convince all of those adults to get vaccinated.
And your article mentions that Dr. Fauci says there is no one hard number that defines herd immunity and that his office has basically stopped using the term as opposed to the idea of a sliding scale. The more people who are vaccinated, the more infections will go down. Well, yeah, that's certainly a true statement that the more people are vaccinated, the more infections will go down. But from a public health messaging standpoint, do you think he's hoping that that language might accomplish more to fight vaccine hesitancy rather than pushing for a national goal of 80% or anything like that?
I really think that the definition and the way that they're framing it has changed, not because they think that will go over better, but just because I think there's a consensus among a lot of scientists now that herd immunity is just not achievable. We're not going to get to that percent, that 80% or whatever it might be anytime soon. But that may not be what matters in the end. What we really care about is to ease the pressure on the healthcare system to reduce the number of hospitalizations and deaths. And what Dr. Fauci and all the experts that I talked with for this article were saying is that we can forget about the herd immunity threshold. That's, you know, we've been fixated on that for about a year, but let's move away from that and really just talk about what's important, which is vaccinating as many of the high-risk people as we can so that the only people who are still getting infected are young and healthy people who may not get as sick. So we would bring overall the number of hospitalizations and deaths down to some manageable level.
You cite experts saying rather than disappear, the virus will become a manageable threat that will circulate in the country for years to come. On reopening and with what kinds of rules do we reopen, but trying to reopen as fully as possible everywhere now, but again, with what kinds of rules and guidelines, because the scientists now believe the virus will not disappear, but rather become a manageable threat. What do they mean by manageable?
So by manageable, they mean that the vast majority of people who get infected will not get really seriously ill. So we might see, you know, a few hundred people in the hospital rather than 40,000, or we might see a few thousand people in the hospital, or we might see a few hundred deaths rather than, you know, thousands and thousands of deaths. And so what they're saying is basically we will still see outbreaks, but they won't be these overwhelming, massive outbreaks that require us to shut huge parts of society down.
And you report that the U.S. has already brought the hospitalization and death rates way down compared to the start of the pandemic. I think everybody knows that. But how much is that because older people have had a high rate of choosing to get vaccinated compared to younger people, and it's the older people who tended to get hospitalized or to die at the most frequent rates?
That's a really big part of it. I mean, we've really brought those numbers down because fewer of the high-risk people are still vulnerable. And we have to keep going along those lines because there are still some elderly and some high-risk people who haven't yet been vaccinated. Part of that is that we haven't done a really great job yet of reaching out to communities of color, making sure that we get to all the people who can't bring themselves over to a vaccination site in order to get the vaccine. And so we have to get to all of those people. But the more of them we vaccinate and protect, the smaller those numbers will get over time. But I do want to say that there is probably also an element of seasonality that we may be seeing some of the decline just because this is what we see, right? The virus goes up, the virus comes down. The numbers go up, we all are a little bit more careful, the numbers come down. So some of that could also just be this up and down we've been seeing, and we can't just rest on our laurels and assume that the numbers are never going to come back up again.
I wonder how much of the lower hospitalization and death rates are because of better treatment options. For example, and I'm curious if you've seen this, I saw a TV commercial a few times the last few days for monoclonal antibodies, and it really shocked me the first time I saw it. You know, like right there between the car commercials and the beer commercials was one showing senior citizens looking frail and scared as they are informed that they just tested positive for COVID. And like any other prescription drug commercial, it says something like, ask your doctor if monoclonal antibodies are right for you. Does that mean that the treatment that President Trump famously had that wasn't widely available to the general public at that time now is?
Well, the thing about monoclonal antibodies is it's been actually interesting because the companies have been trying to get the treatments out to more people. It's a little bit complicated to give that treatment because people have to be on IV. It's not, you know, just an oral pill or even an injection, although they're trying to make it into an injection. You know, you have to be hooked up to an IV. And so it's just a little too complicated for a lot of hospitals to really manage with a lot of patients. And so people who really want it and need it haven't been able to have access to it. So I think this advertising campaign is part of their goal to try and raise awareness so that patients start asking their doctors for the treatment, and that, you know, the uptake of this treatment goes up a little bit. But you are right that part of the reason the numbers are going down is because we just have a better handle on what to do when somebody shows up to a hospital now. You know, it's not like last year when doctors were just sort of flying blind and trying anything they could think of, you know, hydroxychloroquine or whatever the case may be. Now there's, you know, a lot more information on which treatments work and at what stage of treatment, stage of disease they need to be given in order for the treatments to work. So we've made a lot of progress along those lines.
I want to ask you a question left over from our previous segment that maybe you know the answer to. We were talking about New York City restaurants being able to open at full capacity with the new rules that Governor Cuomo announced yesterday. Full capacity in restaurants if they either have a vaccine proof of status or negative COVID test status requirement, or they have these barriers, I guess, plexiglass or whatever they are, barriers between tables. So you don't have to have 6-foot distance between tables in a restaurant if you have these barriers. And a caller said, you know, then we should be able to smoke in restaurants again, because smoke travels a lot like COVID aerosols or maybe COVID droplets do. Do you, as a science reporter, know if that's true?
That's a very smart caller because they're absolutely right. The plexiglass barriers do absolutely nothing. It's just hygiene theater, as we call it. It just has the appearance of doing something, but the virus doesn't just stop at whatever height you are. It's going to rise in the air. It's going to be, just like smoke. It's going to get past those plexiglass barriers. This is something we talked about a lot actually during the election debates. And I spoke to experts then because we were noticing that that was basically the arrangement, is to have some plexiglass barriers. And I thought that we had moved past that, but clearly not.
Then why do medical professionals wear those plastic shields over their faces? Because they're not sealed. They just seem to prevent people from actually like spitting accidentally on the healthcare workers.
That's true, but the healthcare workers are also wearing other masks for their nose and mouth. So it's just an extra layer. I mean, you're not going to see healthcare workers wearing only those face shields. The face shields will protect their eyes, and they add an extra layer of protection because the virus would have to come from underneath, right? So it's a little bit of more of a protection, but just having that and not having a mask would not work.
And about healthcare workers, NPR this morning had a story about stalling vaccination rates in rural areas. So, for example, a quarter of rural hospitals have less than half their staff vaccinated, was one stat that I heard. But even in New York City, Apoorva, according to city data that I've seen reported, only half of EMS workers and firefighters have chosen to get vaccinated. And as I understand it, they've had full access through their jobs since the beginning of the vaccine rollout. Is it because their demographics just put them significantly in those hesitant groups? Or do you have a sense of, why even people on the front lines of healthcare are proving hesitancy at those percentage rates?
I mean, I think it's not entirely, a surprising, right, that people would have a little bit of skepticism about a vaccine that was developed fairly quickly. I mean, at the beginning of the pandemic, we heard that we probably wouldn't have vaccines for quite a while because it takes a long time to make them. And that is usually true. We just got very, very lucky with these mRNA vaccines that they were so fast to make and they work so well. But, some proportion of the population is probably looking and thinking, well, they must have cut some steps. They must have, taken some shortcuts, and I just don't know, and I want to wait and see. I would like to think anyway that that 50% that hasn't gotten vaccinated will go down to a lot less, maybe 20%, as the people see that their colleagues have gotten the vaccine, haven't grown horns or anything, still seem fine, and it seems safe, and also that it's really protecting their colleagues, that they're not getting infected. I think that real world information about both safety and effectiveness may go a long way towards convincing them. And the other thing that I heard from an expert I spoke to for this herd immunity piece is that it's always very important for people to see someone they trust. So, if they don't trust Dr. Fauci, for example, it won't matter how many times he goes on TV and talks about this. It may be that they need to see, a former firefighter or somebody they really respect who says, "Hey, look, I got this vaccine and I'm okay, and you should too." It might really have to come down to that level of appeal and trust.
Hospitals often require the annual flu shots for their staffers. Why won't they just require it for this?
This was a little bit tricky. I think I'm not entirely sure about the legality, but there are some questions about whether hospitals can require their healthcare workers to get vaccinated when the vaccine is not fully approved. As you know, the vaccines have what's called emergency use authorization from the FDA, and that's, it's a temporary approval, if you will. And so I know that the companies are planning to apply for full approval, and once they're fully approved, it opens up a lot more room for companies and schools and other places to require vaccines in a way that it's a little harder to do with just emergency use authorization.
Danielle in Rutherford, you're on WNYC with New York Times Global Health and Science correspondent Apoorva Mandavilli. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was trying to understand for countries that have been faster with their vaccine rollout and have started to open up, what they have been doing about people with young children. So if you need to show your vaccine card or to show a proof of a negative COVID test, well, to go into an establishment, how can you really do that with a baby or little kids? And people are traveling with their children. So what are the examples we're seeing around the world? And what are the plans being rolled out for our own, like New York and New Jersey, rollouts to do with people with children?
It's a great question, and there are so many, I don't have to tell you, Apoorva, I'm sure, or most of the listeners, so many parents grappling with what kinds of summer vacations they can take with their vaccinated selves but their unvaccinated children.
Yeah, this is an extremely complicated issue, and I wish that I could tell the caller that there's a very simple solution here, but I think every state is sort of figuring it out on its own, and every establishment is deciding on its own what the guidelines are. The good news is at least we will have vaccines for kids 12 to 15, because Brian, as you mentioned earlier, that authorization is coming really soon. We hope as early as later this week. And so those kids at least will be protected. And we all already know that kids 16 and over can get it. So it will really be a matter of 12 and under. And I think those vaccines are coming soon. Those trials are underway and we should have them hopefully in the fall sometime. And until then, you know, it is going to have to be up to the family to figure out what their risk tolerance is and to make sure that they really check with the airline or the country or the bar or wherever it is they want to go with their kids to that they will be allowed in, because everybody's making their own choices along those lines.
So the Pfizer vaccine in particular, it's being reported, will now be approved for 12 to 15-year-olds probably next week. Do you happen to know why Pfizer and not Moderna?
That trial just went a lot faster. I mean, Pfizer has been, you know, a little bit ahead of Moderna almost the whole way through. Part of that could just be that their vaccines are spaced 3 weeks apart rather than four. So the trial may have just moved through a little faster. And certainly, you know, these results came out 3 or 4 weeks ago, and Moderna's results are not even out yet. And the results looked really, really good. They showed that kids 12 to 15 produce almost better antibodies than people older than that. And they didn't seem to show any bad side effects, really, or at least comparable to what was seen in the 16 to 25 age group. So it's looking really promising. I do think we'll see the Moderna results fairly soon, though, probably in the next few weeks.
Is Johnson & Johnson testing on kids, too?
Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca, Novavax, everybody's in the kids game, too, but they're all a little bit behind.
You know, I've seen pushback to the ethics of this rollout for 12 to 15-year-olds, like from Johns Hopkins epidemiologist Jennifer Nuzzo, who says something like, we would be using doses to vaccinate low-risk kids in this country while high-risk adults around the world still don't have access to the vaccine.
Yeah, this is it's a very tricky issue. You know, Jennifer Nuzzo has kids of her own, and I've talked to her a lot over this past year about kids in schools. And even for this particular quote that you just read out, I had reached out to her actually to ask about how she felt about the coming authorization. And I was expecting her to say, you know, this is great, because that's what a lot of other people said. And, you know, when she brought up that issue, it is really a big ethical question with no easy answers, because we, you know, there are just millions and millions of adults in other countries, in Brazil and in India, especially right now, who could really benefit from this vaccine. So is it ethical for us to try and vaccinate our kids who are much lower risk than those adults? I don't know. You know, I have family in India. I have an uncle in the hospital right now. And just about every Indian person I know has family in hospitals, family who are really struggling with COVID. So it is a little bit hard to figure out what the right answer is. You know, people will say, oh, Pfizer is hard to store, so maybe that's not even an option for these countries. That may be the case, but we do know that the U.S. at least has a lot of extra doses of AstraZeneca sitting around, so those could actually at least be donated. But these are very tricky questions to navigate.
Who would make that allocation decision? Would it have to be President Biden?
Yeah, it's the White House. And they are getting a lot of pressure. There have been, you know, appeals from Democratic senators. There was just a statement earlier that the majority of House Democrats are pushing for patent waivers, which means basically that the companies would allow other companies in, you know, India and South Africa, these other companies to make vaccines with their technology and make it at much cheaper prices, but also make many more of them. So there is a huge push to try and get the White House to have the companies, you know, waive their patents on these vaccines. But it's unclear whether the White House is really going to go through with that, because whenever I've asked anyone who would know, like Dr. Fauci, you know, the answer is always very diplomatic. Well, you know, we understand the need, but we also have to vaccinate the people here in this country first.
Apoorva Mandavilli, New York Times reporter focusing on science and global health. So informative. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.